Distinguished guests, Robin, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'd like to say at the outset how much I've appreciated the addresses of the two previous speakers. Mine will be a bit more subjective than theirs. That's the nature of politics, I suppose, although you could say that John Poynton's comments about liquidity and equity plays were reasonably subjective. Mine will also be a bit more blunter, and that's probably got not to do with the nature of politics, but the nature of the speaker. Before I start, let me say there are some interesting opinion polls in the newspapers today. This analysis was written well in advance of them. I've seen them, but I saw no need to make any changes. This is the third consecutive year I've had the honour of presenting this political outlook for CEDA. As I've said before on this occasion, you need something stronger than crystal balls to present a political outlook in this climate. At least the economy and the business sector work on a reasonably established set of rules and relatively predictable cycles. Politics in Australia works on neither. In fact, it might not even work. It just is. However, the challenge is ahead of me. And I'll take Tim Marnie's lead. I went back and checked just how far I'd misled this audience with my crystal balls last year. It wasn't too bad. The star prediction was that John Durazio wouldn't last in the Carpenter Cabinet. That was on the money and came to pass in fairly short order. You might remember, if you were here, I said I couldn't understand why no one was poking around in his smelly Bayswater City Council background. Well, we now know that someone was. However, I didn't predict that Mr. Durazio's demise would have the effect of bringing us daylight saving. That's not something for crystal balls. You'd have to be actually sitting under a crystal with a bong to have predicted that one. It could only happen here, I suppose. I also predicted that Kim Beazley and Matt Burney would not make it as opposition leaders, that they were failing and they wouldn't last the year. I suggested the Liberals would go to Paul Omadhi and hazarded that he wouldn't be the answer, which is also proving not to be. On the federal scene, I told last year's audience that the AWB scandal would damage the Howard government but not undo the Prime Minister or any of his cabinet. I suggested the war in Iraq would increasingly turn Australians against the government, which it clearly has. Did I get anything spectacularly wrong? Well, luckily no. However, I'm sure I'll make a better fist of it this year. I finished last year by saying that growing unrest in the community over radicals within the Muslim community was a major political issue that needed to be addressed. And I wondered out loud which party would be the first to start talking about limiting Muslim immigration into Australia. As I left the podium, a former colleague, now working at a prestigious national broadsheet, hissed at me that it was an outrageous thing to suggest. I knew at that stage I'd probably got it right. Well, it still hasn't happened, but the politicians are lining up to tell a variety of Muslim leaders that they're not wanted in this country. So I suppose my suggestion is just a hop and a step away. Well, that was last year. What about the year ahead? The good news for Alan Carpenter is that the big game in town this year is federal politics, with a national election due sometime after August 25 and before the start of December. Mr. Carpenter might just get a bit of breathing space because he got none last year after taking over from Jeff Gallop. For that reason, I'll leave state politics till later. So let's look at the federal scene. New Labor leader Kevin Rudd seems to have a forced nine gale filling his sails at the moment, but it's nearly all coming out of a building in Holt Street in Sydney. For those of you unfamiliar with Holt Street, it's the home of Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. The Australian newspaper is Rupert's baby, and it relentlessly chopped up Kim Beazley last year in a sustained campaign the like of which I've rarely seen against an opposition leader in 37 years in the business. Although it must be said that News Limited editors hated Simon Crean with a passion, which just got them Kim Beazley back in the job. Ever since the News Limited ordained Kevin Rudd took over, he's been getting a hero's welcome from the Australian newspaper and other dailies in the group. And I certainly don't think it's a mere coincidence that the highest profile support of Mr. Rudd in the business community comes from local boy made good Sir Rod Eddington, a director of News Limited and a close confidant of Rupert's. Mr. Murdoch has played these games before around the world with politicians of all persuasions and for the same reasons every time. money. So we need to think about what Rupert hasn't got out of John Howard and what he thinks he might be able to get out of Kevin Rudd. Because when you boil it down, it's as simple as that. And just remember this, not one News Limited editor anywhere in the world opposes the Iraq War. That's quite a coincidence when you think about it. And you can bet that all the News Limited papers will coincidentally line up behind Mr. Rudd throughout the year. They only have about 70% of the metropolitan dailies, but they are the market leaders and the opinion formers in most states. TV and radio basically bounces off them, so that's why I concentrate on the newspapers. Most commentators think that John Howard's choice of election day will be built around the APEC Leaders Conference in September, which annoyingly sits in the middle of the available poll dates. But there's still a wild outside chance that he will decide to go early if, come the end of July, there's no point going later and allowing Labor's head of steam to grow even further pressure. Now, there's an amusing side issue here. Even if Mr. Howard loses an early election in August, and that would have to be on August 25, he would have already chosen the silly gear the APEC leaders get to wear at the obligatory photo shoot. Now, we all know that John Howard doesn't mind playing dress-ups. We see him on his morning walks, an unlikely figure in a Wallabies jumper. But he may have the last laugh on Kevin Rudd if the coalition loses and the new PM inherits the clothing selection. This is what I'm betting on for the APEC leaders' photo shoot. A chesty Bond shearer's singlet, made in China, under a Mambo overshirt, made in the Philippines. It'll be neatly coordinated with made in Fiji Yakka stubbies, if we've made up with the Fijians by then, and a pair of made in Thailand Blundstone boots. All of it, of course, will be nicely tied together in the unpredictable September weather by a Dreiser bone, made in Indonesia, of course. I reckon Kevin should look a treat in that. I suppose we have to ask ourselves whether Mr. Howard wants to be seen cozying up to George W. Bush at APEC, very close to an election with the war in Iraq likely to be going increasingly badly. And the answer to that is probably yes. So maybe the election will be in November. On the serious side, there's an emerging factor in this election which is ominous for John Howard, and it's what I call the it's time factor. John Howard has a lot going for him entering this race. The ever-increasing power of incumbency, a stable economy which has been very kind to the Australian families he's stuffed with middle-class welfare payments, a grudging trust which is built on that, and a relative certainty that he can handle difficult issues. Whatever Australians might feel in their hearts about this bloke, they know him, and that's important. Against that, there's a growing list of gnawing complaints that have the ability to coalesce into an it's time shift in voting sentiment, like we saw in 1972 after another long Liberal innings. Here in WA, it's easy to take the myopic view that the Australian economy is booming and everyone's in the money. Now, that is not the case throughout the rest of the nation, as John Poynton noted. We're seeing a multi-level boom, and many parts of the eastern states are completely missing out on it. Money is very tight in many families. Many families are living way above their means on highly extended credit. Many young people can't get a start in life. A lot of it, I must say, through their insistence on a lifestyle they can't afford, but they don't quite know that yet. The political reality is that they may think someone can offer them something better. So disaffection with the state of the economy would be required in some form to underpin an it's time shift and see a chunk of the so-called Howard battlers move off to Kevin Rudd. The other obvious issue is the environment, swamped at the moment by climate change and water concerns, but which ranges even wider than those expansive problems. The 9% Greens vote in the recent Peel by-election here in WA is worthy of close study. It's a relatively high vote for the Greens, traditionally, and we know their preferences often flow back heavily to Labor. If it was a reflection of the current environmental hysteria, rather than just part of a Labor protest vote, it would wipe out the coalition if replicated nationally later this year. I'll go back and look at each of these issues separately, but the rest of the it's time issues I see mounting up are contained in the nuclear/uranium debate, which runs into climate change and the war in Iraq. Now, none of those might be a killer punch on their own, but they do have, in my analysis, the ability to come together in people's minds as a feeling that the government has run its race and doesn't have the solutions to pressing problems. Now, as I said, behind that there needs to be some sort of economic difficulty, because we Australians always back hip pocket self-interest first, but if there are economic wobbles in the second half of this year, John Howard is in real trouble. So let's look at these issues. With a mind-boggling lack of preparation of the electorate, Mr Howard decided out of the blue last year to tell Australians that they have a nuclear future. Now, I happen to partly agree with him, but I've found very few Australians willing to agree with me when I've written about this issue over the last 3 years. And I think Mr Howard will have a dickens of a time changing entrenched views on this contentious issue during an election year. For many older Australians, and I disagree with John Poynton here, their views about uranium and nuclear power haven't changed since the 70s and 80s. Their fear of radioactive waste and Chernobyl-style accidents is likely to outweigh their fear of global warming. And they might not be prepared to view nuclear as clean and green as the Prime Minister wants them to see it. The polls show that female voters are significantly against nuclear power in Australia, and most Australians are against it. Complex scientific arguments about the ability of other alternatives to deliver the sort of baseload power needed by a modern society is unlikely to win this debate. My view is that it's much more likely to be won on emotion, and the ability for those who oppose nuclear power to shunt the argument off in the direction of friendly alternatives like solar and wind, or even so-called clean coal. It appears Mr Howard thinks he can wedge Labor between its outdated and irrational uranium mining policy and the desire for Australia to use its own big uranium resources to solve our greenhouse emissions problems. I think that underestimates Labor's ability to come up with a rational policy to free up Australian uranium mining while still opposing nuclear power. Enough of the states seem to want uranium mining to force a change to the free mines, no new mines policy. But that doesn't mean that Labor then has to adopt nuclear power for Australia on the basis that it's helping and condoning the use of nuclear power in other countries. Logic and rationality have never been big in the nuclear debate. Labor will almost certainly come out of its national conference at the end of April with a realistic uranium policy, but still opposing nuclear power for Australia. Now that leaves John Howard holding Ziggy Switkowski's 20 nuclear power stations in your backyard, baby. While Mr Rudd says that he's helping save China and India's emissions problems while not endangering Australians. John Howard's had a long time to convince Australians that we need nuclear power, and I think he's waited too long to change such entrenched views in such a short electoral time frame. As in the wider greenhouse and water issues, Mr Howard is paying the nuclear price for being slow to see the political landscape changing. The war in Iraq is another potential headache for John Howard. Kevin Rudd is being a real dog in the manger over Iraq, and he may yet come unstuck, as Mark Latham did, over how to frame a deadline for the withdrawal of Australia's small troop commitment. Certainly his efforts over the weekend in saying that would depend on the stage of the troop rotations was particularly weak, but it wasn't questioned. As he comes out of his honeymoon period and into the bear pit of the election campaign, he will be less able to get away with rubbish like that. I'm not saying that Australians will vote Mr Howard out over the war, but it will be another one of those issues that can become an amalgam of vote-changing sentiment. The key issue Mr Howard needs to reverse this year is the hysteria over climate change and his government's response to it. Mr Rudd has been able to exploit John Howard's natural conservatism to what he sees as left-wing green sentiments over the environment by painting the Prime Minister as a climate change sceptic who is unable to address what many Australians see as the pressing issue of a lifetime. Now, I agree with Tim Marnie I also don't think it was unreasonable for us not to sign the Kyoto protocols in terms of the sort of country we are, dependent on resources, and the fact that our competitors weren't being bound by it. However, the politics were bad, and that's the difference between good policy and bad politics. At the moment, the momentum is with Mr Rudd. That doesn't mean it'll stay there. Holding the levers of power gives Mr Howard an enormous ability to create an impression in the mind of voters that he's doing something. Oppositions only look like they're talking about something. While Mr Rudd is trying to look like a Prime Minister in exile, using the state premiers as a de facto cabinet out to set the world right, that approach is unsustainable, as Mr Howard has shown when he pulled the rug out from under those who opposed his national water strategy. The levers of power also give Mr Howard the chance to bribe the voters again in the May budget. Having stuffed Australian families with cash before the last two elections, there's little doubt that Peter Costello will be required to do it again this time round. We've now got to the stage that the average Australian family with two kids effectively pays no taxation up to $50,000 of income. The family allowance is so entrenched that it's not even questioned as anything out of the norm in Australia, whereas it is social welfare of such an extraordinary extent that it would have made a young John Howard froth at the mouth. I suspect there's more of it to come in May, whether we can afford it or not. The final issue I want to address on the federal scene is industrial relations. Labor's doomsday predictions about the Howard government's work choices changes may not start biting within this electoral cycle. That would neutralise the issue. The hardline union opposition to the changes only play to the converted. For IR to become a more potent election issue, there needs to be enough of an economic downturn for unemployment to start growing, and I can't see that happening by October. However, Kevin Rudd has real problems with the promise to rip up the IR changes, especially in the mining states. Now, this is not so much about winning votes, but about winning the confidence of business. If he goes too far towards business, he will alienate further the unions, who are not fans of his, and would turn feral if he starts to dub them. So I don't rate IR as a first-rank election issue, but as a significant undercurrent. In rounding off the federal scene, John Howard is further behind than I would have thought he'd be at this stage, mainly because of Mr Rudd's very good start in the job. I calculated earlier that Labor had left the change of leader too late for Mr Rudd to gain the hearts and minds of Australians within a year. However, the emerging hot issues play out well for a fresh-faced political pup, particularly when the old dog is looking a bit mangy. The game is on, and the election is winnable for Labor. However, if the economy stays strong, if we don't have a rash of deaths in Iraq, and in the absence of icebergs floating off Cottesloe Beach, my money would be on the coalition because they campaign better and they hold the levers of government. So what about the state scene? I am hedging my bets a bit federally, but I'm prepared to say that there is no way that the Liberals can win the next state election due late next year or early in 2009. Now, it is absolute lunacy to pick an election this far out, but they don't call me Mooner for nothing. Alan Carpenter presides over an ordinary government. His biggest problems are a lack of horsepower in cabinet, poor political judgment, and an absence of clearly understood objectives. He has three first-ranked ministers, McGuinty, Ripper and McTiernan. Against this, the opposition has made no gains over the past 2 years as the government has floundered. My four reasons for making such a rash prediction are these. One, the increasing power of incumbency in Australian elections. Two, the state's economic momentum, which will not turn down appreciably within the electoral timeframe. West Australians are increasingly self-absorbed about their own financial situation and won't vote out of government for nothing appreciably better when they're coining it. Three, the one vote, one value changes have lifted the bar substantially for the Liberals and made its very existence questionable for the rump Nationals. And four, the lack of strong business support for the Liberal opposition. A weak opposition becomes a very dangerous political combination for the public when you have an average government. The opposition is paying the price for decades of political corruption of the Liberal Party's internal processes. The party is driven by factions, which has led to pre-selections in which the best candidates were not attracted and the best of what was available was often not chosen. The party often says it finds it impossible to attract good political talent from its gene pool because of the salaries and the lifestyle. Well, there is some merit in that, but there is no chance that they'll get anyone of merit when the party is such a basket case, and there's no sign it will change. The Liberals seem to have difficulty working out where their support base is these days. Natural supporters, like the hotel industry, get rolled because of nothing more significant than the party's leadership worries. We saw that happen in the liquor changes just last year. People in business notice things like that. Why would you cosy up to the Liberals when they treat traditional supporters in such a fashion? You're better off taking your chances with the Labor government. Even the Chamber of Commerce and Industry is friendlier to this government than to the opposition. The Liberals have reversed some of the old political certainties of life in Perth because of their own ineffectiveness and poor political judgment. The change from Colin Barnett to Matt Burney was a strange gamble. The change to Paul Omadhi is one that few people in the party faced with any confidence. I don't meet any Liberals who will honestly look you in the eye and tell you that Mr. Omadhi can win them an election. So why is he there? One of Brian Burke's lingering legacies is the four-year term. It certainly hasn't given us the better government with longer-term aims and planning that we were promised, but it should have given us better prepared oppositions, and it hasn't. The next state election is 2 years away, and there's no indication that the Liberals will get their leadership, sponsorship and pre-selection problems squared away anytime soon. So what about the government over the course of this year? Clearly one of the big issues is tax reform. Eric Ripper has already let it slip that there'll be stamp duty relief for first home buyers in the coming budget. The state taxation review, with its enormously long 2 year horizon, has been a political sham, but it is one that will eventually deliver for Labor. Labor needs to put our housing affordability crisis at a 23-year nadir to bed during the course of the next 18 months, or at least show that it can put it to bed. It will hope to do that with a blend of taxation relief stemming from the review and a more realistic approach to land release. It's expected that the State Tax Review Committee's report, due before the May budget, will propose four separate packages. There's speculation of a lift in the stamp duty-free threshold for first home buyers from $250,000 to $450,000. There'll be cuts to stamp duty on all property conveyances of between 5 to 10%. Won't there, Tim? A rent assistance scheme for private tenants will help the new crisis of exorbitant rentals, and there may even be a reduction in land taxes for developers. If all that comes about, John Langalant should be sitting in Eric Ripper's lap again. Health, mainly hospitals, and education will clearly remain high on the political agenda this year, but I see no major changes of policy there or any particular potential challenges from the opposition to make that worthwhile to pursue this morning. So what are the other political developments facing the government? Well, Mr. Carpenter needs to learn from the mistakes of the OBE debate. Whatever your view about the OBE changes, the issue was politically mishandled over a very long period. Governments just can't afford to be fighting fires all the time. It eventually turns the public off because it makes the administration look accident-prone and not credible. The uranium debate at the ALP's national conference looms as a significant issue for Mr. Carpenter. If his group of naysayers lose, as appears likely, it will be another telling defeat for him. It'll once again disclose his inability to position himself skillfully in these fluid political situations. Mr. Carpenter has the zealot's ability to paint himself into a corner on policy issues. While on the one hand that may appear and be principled, it's simply not good politics when the situation is so obviously changing. The flow on from Labor's national difficulties over Australian workplace agreements will also create problems here for state Labor. Kevin Rudd's meandering on the policy will have mining companies increasingly putting pressure on state Labor to hold the line. However, I think the heaviest pressure on the Carpenter government this year will be caused by the extraordinary demands of the resources boom. And Tim Mahoney touched on this too, and so did John. I'd actually reverse Tim Mahoney's 1-5 and go the other way around. WA is not keeping up with the demands for infrastructure and skilled workers. This is probably the fundamental political issue facing the Premier this year and the one he needs to fix the most. The May budget, with the expectation of a big surplus, offers Labor an opportunity to put in place the sort of far-sighted policies that will not only fix some of our entrenched problems, but secure Labor's political future. Mr. Carpenter needs to make some big, potentially unpopular decisions on our water supplies during the course of the year. How the Premier handles the politics of South West Water will be a measure of his leadership. Yarragadee, in my view, remains a much more realistic first option than further fuel-dependent desalination or the remediation of the Serpentine Dam in what remains a drying climate. And here's a final thought for you. Richard Court lost office for the Liberal Party in 2001 as our economy came off the boil and the government lost the plot on spending. In my view, as I've said, there's little prospect of Labor losing power again before 2013. I can't see it losing the 2009 election, so there's no chance to get them out of office until 2013. The next two boom revenue budgets, if handled properly, could secure government for Labor until 2017. And it could do that by giving Labor such an electoral majority next up at the next election that it will take two elections to claw back. And we've seen that happen many times in this state, where an electoral landslide, no matter how bad that government has been and how good the opposition's been at the next election, you just can't win enough seats to overturn the losses of the landslide. I'm sure the Premier will let you in on his plans over lunch. And just in closing, I just want to talk about Tim Mahoney's comments on Aboriginal disadvantage. I was really encouraged to hear a senior Treasury boffin talk like that. It's often easy to see people in positions like Tim's as being disengaged from our community, and I appreciate the insight that they're not. Thanks for your attention today.